You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And today we're going to talk about education. We've been having now a series of conversations about education. And we're going to actually talk to someone who is on the ground educating young people. And educating young people in disadvantaged and poor neighborhoods. Aaron Bass has spent a long 20-year career in education. And he is now the CEO of Eastside Charter School in Delaware. And he's going to tell us about the remarkable work that they're doing there to educate kids who statistics would have us write off as not being able to amount to anything. In fact, many young people in similar situations do struggle mightily in life. But Aaron is turning those statistics upside down.
As a parent, you're kind of hyper-focused on making sure, yes, they get the education, but that social piece is really important, and it's here. So I call Eastside the triple threat, because your family, you're going to be ready for whatever school you're going into, and they're going to get you socially prepared to be a successful citizen.
His kids are achieving great success, and his parents are engaged in their education. His teachers are motivated, and they are just doing remarkable work. So we're going to have this conversation with Aaron. Aaron, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Perfect. Glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, Aaron, you've been in this education space for some time. I mean, I guess, what, maybe 20 years or so?
2001, September 11th was actually my first year teaching. And before that, I was actually teaching when I was in high school and in college. So I started formally in 2001, but I've been teaching since 1996.
Well, this is great, because one of the things I truly believe in is mentoring. And a lot of times, because of my years of experience in this world and in the nonprofit sector, people will come to me and say, "Can you mentor me? I want you to give me advice," and so forth. And I always say to them, "Well, it's a two-way street. I expect you to mentor me as well." And tonight, I think I'm going to have an opportunity to be mentored, reverse mentored, if you would, by someone who is significantly younger than me, but still experienced and has a lot to say and teach us about education and what's going on, particularly in the K-12 space. So I'm really glad to have you on the show. And I guess I want to start off by asking you simply, what motivated you to engage in education as a career?
Wow. Well, it means a lot to be giving advice to Art. So just to start off, that's very impressive. And I never thought I'd be able to do that. I've learned a lot from you over the years, too. So thank you for your leadership, sir. For answering your question, that's how I actually started in education, was the Million Man March, 1996. I was in high school. I attended a private school in Philadelphia and got a chance to leave my predominantly white institution, head down to DC, and was surrounded by a million brothers and had so much passion and energy and emotion on that day. And when the day ended, I tried to figure out, so what's next? So it was this moving experience. And a lot of people had just left, and that was the end of it. And when I got back to Philadelphia, I started teaching, and I started teaching in Germantown. I was at my private school, and I taught students at a few different public schools surrounding our area, and I was a community scholar to my high school. So what that meant was I was a scholarship kid. It was a community scholarship, and they selected 4 students out of 144 that went through their interview process.
Wow.
So I was one of the 4 students, got a full ride to this school. It was Germantown Friends School. So went to Germantown Friends, got accepted, and I was accepted when I was 12 years old. So it didn't really hit me. It was just, oh, that's the path I'm going on. Started realizing a lot of my peers around me in the same zip code weren't having the same experiences I was having as far as the college process or learning that summer was a verb and not just a noun.
Yeah.
So when students summered there, it meant they were heading off to be in Martha's Vineyard. They were heading off to different places and they were actively engaging in something. And summer was just when school wasn't happening. So you hung out in the street and you did whatever you needed to do. You went to some camps, but it was just something that happened and not that you'd be actively engaged. We didn't have a lot of parents that were lawyers and doctors and ran the community and in the legislature. So my peers didn't have opportunities that I had. I came back from the Million Man March and realized I got to do something. So I started teaching my own neighborhood. And I did that for a few years, did it throughout college, and then joined Teach for America in 2001 when I graduated from Franklin and Marshall. And that even happened because I started looking at, well, what do you do when you graduate? And I had no answers. And the one thing I was passionate about was education. And so I joined Teach for America in 2001. I chose Atlanta, and I remember my essay, you had to choose why you picked your region, and it was maybe a 500-word essay, and I wrote, I love Black people. That was my entire essay of why I chose Atlanta, and I taught there for a couple years. So for me, it's about long-winded answer, having an impact on your community. I see education as the civil rights movement of my generation and every generation. And if you're going to impact power, if you're going to change an entire system, if you're going to look at equity, then you have to be able to have strong educated masses. And that's why I've looked at education as being a field to make societal change.
So the Million Man March was your clarion call to service, essentially.
Yes, my clarion call. I like that.
Yeah. You saw what was going on and the beauty of that day, and you wanted to make sure that your life was in some way used to help others to move this agenda forward. That's impressive. And, you know, on this podcast, we try to uncover what it is that drives people to give and serve. And this is a great example of how we can move others to a life of service just by how we engage them. You know, the march engaged you, the men there engaged you. There was probably people in that audience among that million men who probably hoped that they would stimulate an interest in someone like you to do something, but probably had no real idea that they did. But I have to tell you, I'm sure that if they knew that just by being there and showing up, little thing like that could influence you to a life of service, it would make them feel real good. And it might also, by the way, help other people appreciate that the little things they do can have a huge impact on what other people do with their lives. And, you know, that's really what I'm all about, you know, at this point in my life. So I'm really glad to hear that. I'm really glad to hear that it was an event, something that maybe you didn't even know it was going to happen, but at the end it made you get involved in a career that is really going to impact and has been impacting a lot of folk. So now you mentioned that as a teenager almost you were teaching. I mean, how does that happen? How do you become a teacher? So they had this program and they said, we're looking for high school kids who want to teach. I mean, what was that deal?
The program was called, at the time, Summer Bridge, where they asked for high school and college students to teach middle school students. And after I got back, the program had been in place for 1 year, and I said, that's what I need to do. And I could teach students in my own neighborhood that looked like me, that came from the same houses as I did, but didn't have the same opportunities as me. And I was also realizing that my space in this private school was not because I was special. So maybe I just tested right on a certain day. Maybe I just happened to know these certain answers, but that it wasn't necessarily fair. So how do I make sure that everyone has access to an incredible education, just like I'm getting? And that's what I was inspired to do after the Million Man March.
So here's a question for you. Now you're head of the Eastside Charter School, which is a network, I might add, of schools, right?
It's not a network. So we have right now we are one K-8, and we've started a new honors program that is launched this year, actually launched 2 years ago, and that's at a different campus right now.
Okay. And how does this relate to the educational system in Delaware and Newcastle around where you are?
So Eastside Charter School is in the Riverside community. And just to give you some history of it, Eastside was the first school in America that was zoned for a housing project. So there's the Riverside housing projects that are across the street from Eastside Charter School. And the charter school was zoned to make sure that children in that the housing authority had access to this school. Riverside is the pick whatever indicator you want in terms of the highest crime, the highest recidivism rate, lowest unemployment, low educational attainment, whatever that thing happens to be that you would look at for a high need area, Riverside is that area. For Eastside Charter School, we happen to have amongst the highest amount of low income children percentage wise in the entire state. We are also our students on an ACEs survey. So ACEs survey is how you measure trauma. It is used in war zones. It is used in prisons. In the state of Delaware, for adults about 25 years and older, the average person 25 years and up scores a 25% score a 1 on the ACEs inventory. So for a grown person in the state of Delaware, about 25% score a 1 on this survey. Our school, 80% of our children score a 1. A 1 is they've experienced trauma. So a quarter of all adults in the state, 80% of our students that are kindergarten through 8th grade. One third of our students have experienced 3 or more experiences of trauma. Just for context, 3 or more is what is equivalent to those who are returning back to jail on a frequent basis. It's used for recidivism rates. Mm. One third of our children experience the same amount of trauma as inmates that are released and then brought back and released and brought back because of constant trauma. And that is the context in which I work. That is also, it's amazing that within this environment, we have a lot of hope. We have a lot of work we put into it. I'm not just the leader of the institution. I'm also a parent. My wife and I have our 2 children. They attend. We are proud parents of Eastside Charter School. We have a number of our staff that have also put their children in Eastside. So it's amazing to see how if you're really going to be about this work, if you're really talking about making seismic impacts in education, then I want to see what you do with your own children. And if your children cannot be in an academic environment in which you lead, then there's a bigger problem with what you are proposing that you're doing. So we want to make sure that for the environment that has the trauma, the low income, the poverty, pick whatever indicator is, we want the best education possible. So to give you some stats about the school.
Well, wait, before you do that, let me ask you, I just hold on to that thought. Let me give you this one. What are we talking about when we say trauma? Give me some a sense of what we mean by that.
I have experienced children that have come to school the next day after their mother's boyfriend has committed suicide with a gun in the house. I have experienced children that have been displaced because they are homeless, We have children that have been adjudicated youth. We have children who have witnessed all types of violence. We have children who have been sexually molested. We have children that have experienced some intense trauma. So when we're saying trauma, we mean the ACEs inventory is something that people use after a war zone. So after you have a humanitarian crisis, an ACEs inventory is what is used to look at the population that just had an impact of that war. So that's the type of trauma we're talking about. And what's more just indescribable is how do you do that when you're seven?
Wow, man, just it's hard to even take that in, that kids are going through that kind of thing. And then when we say, well, we want them to be educated citizens so that they can fend for themselves in this world. Wow. Okay, man, give me some of the stats that you were going to share with me about the situation.
What's amazing is in this area that statistically should not be thriving, we have seen our students, we started an honors program out of this school that has everything going against it. In the 2 years we've started our honors program, those students have earned $377,000 in scholarships, financial aid to private institutions for high school. And they are staying at those private schools. This same school just had scores on the state assessment. Our middle school beat the state average in every content on the state assessment. So pick whatever assessment, these children surpassed the state averages at the same time the state went down. We're seeing these same children, our suspension rates have dropped 75% for 2 years before the pandemic. So we've been tracking our suspension data well before the pandemic. And then when the pandemic hit, we were looking at our data and realized we've saved 750 days of suspension with the same children. Why is that important? It's important because, one, we're keeping the same children. We are retaining over 85% of our kids every year. This is happening with a transient population where you have homelessness, you have a lot of other issues taking place. We're retaining our same kids, and those same kids are staying in school longer. So those same children that have every right to lash out, or those same children have every reason to be mad at society, are learning.
Okay, so how are you doing this? I mean, because I hear all sorts of things about what's happening in schools where the population of students generally come from low income or in some cases no income backgrounds. In fact, I don't know if you read it, but I came across a story recently about a student in Baltimore who had a 0.18 cum, I think it was 0.13 cum, something like that. And he was almost in the middle of his class, from a GPA standpoint. And he had been passed along from freshman to sophomore to junior to senior. And they finally got midway into his senior year and told him that he was not going to graduate and that he needed to start all over because he essentially only passed four classes and failed something like 22. He missed 270 days of school in 4 years. And his mother, who is a single mom with other children, didn't know until his senior year that he wasn't going to graduate. So she's now taking action against the school. And, you know, what was startling about this, his story was startling enough. But what was even more startling to me was that, again, he was in the middle of his class. So there were half of the students that were doing worse than he was. And Aaron, I just want to know, what are people doing? What are they doing with these kids? What are they doing? I mean, if you're a teacher, what are you doing if you have that many kids who are just failing every class? And what are we doing when we say we have to pass these kids along? You figured something out. What are you doing that's different?
So, one, we don't have any silver bullet. Our ethos is love. our ethos is we love our students, we love our community, and we're going to operate out of a place of love, which means that we're going to have some hard conversations with families. It means that, you know, with a tough conversation, I'm coming out of a place of love, and I am treating your child the same way I would treat my own in the same school that my own children go to. It means that we have staff. Eastside, for example, three, four years ago, Eastside was losing 2/3 of our staff every year. So for the children that had the highest amount of trauma, the most inconsistent backgrounds in their lives would come to a school that offered them inconsistency. We started focusing on how to retain our staff. This past month, we were just named one of the top places in the state of Delaware to work and retain over 90% of our staff.
Wow.
And what's working is we actually started tracking our data, having really transparent conversations with our staff. Our staff started investing in the work that we're doing, and now they have children, from administrators, teachers, paraprofessionals. Everybody is now pushing their children towards being in this school that, by all statistical purposes, should not survive. And so what we're doing is we spend the time. We build those relationships. We believe in what is audacious. And we are relentless at making sure that we can hit that. We have a lot of work to do. So I don't want to present a world that is free of any problems.
Sure, of course.
We have students who are being and doing what adolescents do.
Yeah.
And they're doing it with some background, some informed by trauma. So they're making decisions that are even more problematic for them. But we also have invested in social emotional learning. So what does that mean? It means that it doesn't matter how much arithmetic I put in front of you if you haven't invested in yourself and your own self-worth. There's a book I read when I was studying abroad in Ghana by Ikwe Amah called The Healers. And it's really shaped a lot of my thinking. In this book, it's about medical healers that were doing the work of medically healing people. But the deeper part of it was, they cared less about the medical part and cared more about the social emotional part of it. So until you have wellness within your own soul, a lot of this stuff doesn't matter. What are you living for if we can patch you up, but you have nothing to live for? That's not really living. So for young people, the same idea that we want you to be successful in life, but it's not just because you can pass a test. Tell me about, what are your plans? What are your goals? We assess every child. Tell me what you want to be. And then we start putting people in front of them so that you can also see people in those roles and you can access that.
The learning is very interactive. They're very hands-on. They do lots of fun experiments and things to kind of bring the education to life. So it's not all books. They do a lot of things in terms of collaboration. They have different seating and different setup, just to kind of encourage learning and kind of like an open platform.
Two things. One is, I keep hearing that these schools need to customize education to meet the learning processes for kids. Some kids learn by reading, some learn by writing, some learn by watching, you know, some learn by listening, you know, and we don't necessarily cater our education to how kids are equipped to learn. I hear that's part of it. I also hear that the way we go about moving kids from grade to grade, essentially processing them, is antiquated and doesn't match a student-centered learning approach. What do you say about that? Is that true in your opinion, or is that something that maybe is overstated?
I think you're right about it, but I think it's also comes back to who's taking ownership for the children's learning. So as CEO, I take the full weight and responsibility of every child that I educate on my shoulders. And if that's the case, then that means that you will not be able to simply pass the buck. if more educators did that. I was having a conversation today with some parents about what's taking place at other schools. And a parent said, I appreciate the fact that you all have that ownership and that investment in children, because we're not seeing other places. And they started listing problems. But what it came down to is, at the end of the day, the children are mine. And if you don't take that as with that weight, and also if you don't make some adults unhappy, if there are teachers that are not educating children properly, move them out of the way. If there are parents that are making decisions that are detrimental to their children's ability to learn, then you need to get with those parents and actually have those tough conversations. But it's coming out of a place of love and not out of a place of, I'm trying to get you out of my hair.
All right, so let me get into this for a minute. So systemically, you are part of a charter. You're a charter school.
Correct.
The charter school is a public school, right? It's funded by taxpayer dollars. And then there are public schools that are not charter schools. And do they operate from a system standpoint the same way? Because one of the things you mentioned is that if a teacher isn't performing, we can move them out of the way, or we should move them out of the way. Is that something that regular public schools are able to do, or is it something that is simply that a charter school can do that a public school can't? How does that work?
There are private charters, and they're a distinct minority. There's, I don't even know the number, but they're inconsequential. I think for many charter schools, there is more flexibility with staffing. Yeah. The reason we at Eastside are able to have 90% of our staff stay with us is because the staff are invested in the school. They also have a lot more say in our policies. They have a lot more say in curriculum. They have a lot more say in decision making. So it's a lot of times people think that because you're a charter, then you can just get rid of people as you want to. Yeah, but then how do you maintain people? And then how do you have people that also give feedback to others to help them grow? And so that's a bigger piece for us. But at the same time, if there's a person that is damaging children, I think there's a societal issue that we shouldn't accept that. I think in our institutions, it's a larger issue. We have, if you deal with policing, there are police that we accept that should not be in law enforcement.
Right.
There are rules that have kept medical doctors in places they should not be. And so the same thing for our education institutions. If somebody is damaging children, which I think is the highest crime in society because you're damaging future generations, then you need to get out of that system as quick as possible because you're causing so much pain and anguish. So yes, there's more flexibility, but there's also more room for us to then innovate and try to figure out how do we solve these problems and how do we make sure we have the best thing possible.
I hear a lot about, you know, the conflict between different pieces of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it feels like they're in tension and the kids are the ones that end up losing out, you know, and I don't know how to deal with that, but it feels sometimes frustrating. You know, when you hear the teachers say on the one hand that it's not our fault, and you hear the administrators say, well, it's not our fault, and you hear the school district saying, well, it's not our fault, and you hear the parents saying, it's not our fault, you hear the state saying, it's not our fault. Well, whose fault is it? You know, that's what I'm trying to figure out. You know, is it the student's fault? Whose fault? I mean, we can't seem to get the kind of accountability in many places that it takes to drive change and success. And it's frustrating when I hear these stories. It's really frustrating to me.
But that goes back to the passing the buck. And so if you actually have ownership over what you're doing, then you have to problem solve that. So I'll give you an example. You're right that it's easy to say it's the student's fault. Truth is, it's never the student's fault. It's not. We have failed generations and generations of children because adults are fighting adults and children are losing out. So it does mean that if a system is not holding children accountable and teaching them the right things to do, I can tell you what not to do and I can penalize you for that. But if I've never taught you and trained you in what to do, then shame on us. So we looked at that and said, our children are making these bad decisions. We had tons of survey data and discipline data and said, our kids are messing up. So we changed the environment to reduce our suspension rate by 75% while simultaneously increasing our student success rate on assessments. So if you're right, we can't pass the buck, our children are messing up, then how do we teach them what to do? How do you teach a child that's never been taught how to delay gratification to do just that? How do you teach a child that doesn't know how to regulate their emotions to know, you know what, this is the moment that I need to advocate for myself, and this is when I need to be silent, and know that I can be heard because I've lived my life so long not being heard that all I can do is act this certain way? How do you deal with a child that only has tantrums and is yelling because that's the only way they've been taught to communicate? So that was one thing we talked about with students. How do we change the environment? And we worked on that. We've looked at how do we make sure that our children are able to be successful academically. We started partnering because we looked at our community and said, our children need to see a larger world. So we started partnering with private schools. And now our honors program has students that attend our school in Riverside, which I told you about the community. And now they take classes simultaneous at private schools where the average tuition is $27,000 a year.
Wow.
We saw the problem and we said, it's our fault. So we take that initiative. If it's our fault, and if we know that we cannot build a 100-acre campus and provide this experience to our children, then we need to figure out how to do that. So we did that. Our community has a lot of larger systemic issues, and we said, then the community is also our fault. So we're investing $200 million in our community, partnered with Purpose Built, to create what's called Reach Riverside. And we are physically right now recreating our environment, invested $200 million in turning the housing authority into mixed income housing.
Wow.
So a lot of people are saying that's the problem. We're passing the buck. We've actually taken this different approach and saying, hey, we love where we are. We love what we do. So let's recreate the society. But what's even more important is that we're recreating it with the same people. We're keeping the same families in that community. And they also have a seat at the table and talking about, so what should the housing look like? We got past the housing and said, well, you know what? It's not just the housing. It's access to wellness centers. So we're putting a wellness center in there. They said, we don't have anything for our teens to do. So we've built a teen center in that area. We've also looked at the fact that STEM is the number one economic driver in the state of Delaware. It's STEM. So we said, then if economics are an issue, let's put a STEM hub there. And so we're now meeting with our architects to build a STEM hub so that parents can get training in STEM. And our students have access to STEM at a very young age so that they can now, with corporations we're partnering with, the corporations are looking at us to replicate their workforce. So the future workforce is coming out of this place that statistically should not be vibrant. Our school was given to us, the building, for $1 about 15 years ago because the school district said, in this community, we cannot get children in this building. So this school district gave Eastside, which was a charter school about 20 years ago, they said, you guys take it. Eastside went from, we can't get people in this building, to now we have to build another 20,000 square feet because we don't have enough room in this building. Mm. So to your point about ownership, own the environment.
Own the environment.
And then innovate to make sure that you can be successful.
Own the environment. Wow. So $200 million investment. Where's that coming from?
Purpose Built is, it's a national organization. Warren Buffett is one of the people on board, and Shirley Franklin, and they wanted to recreate the community. So they help with getting fundraising happening. So there's private donors, there's public dollars. The Wilmington Housing Authority is also on board with us. And so they have invested dollars. There is money that it's private and public that are making this happen. And it's amazing because what used to be conceptual, we now have construction taking place and is slated to be done within months from now.
Wow, wow, wow. That is amazing. Because we keep hearing, you know, your zip code kind of determines what your education is going to be. And we got to deal with the social problems. We can't expect the teachers to feed them. We can't expect the school to house them. We can't expect the school to clothe them. We can't expect the school to do all that. It's got to be on the parents. It's got to be on the community, you know. And what you're saying is we're going to take ownership for this community. We're going to make sure that when a kid walks into our school, they have what they need and that they're safe when they go home and that they have a roof over their head, good food, clothing, place, things to do after school. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Our community was just flooded and we had families dispossessed and we raised $6,000 and started putting cash in our family's hands and working with state services to house every family that got flooded through Hurricane Ida. Again, like if you need food, we got food for you. You need clothing. We have a clothing bank. And that's, I think the mentality has to be stop passing the buck and take ownership. And then you are relentless until you can either meet the need or find someone that can.
It makes other people more comfortable when they see who's leading. I see a lot of Mr. Bass. To see the things that he's done in the community, to see the things that he is doing in the community, it really relieves some pressure on where my children are and what the foundation of the school is.
Wow. I mean, this is so powerful. So let me ask you, Aaron, do you think this is replicable or is this simply the power of Aaron Bass and those associated with him who decided they were going to take this on and make it happen in this community? How do we replicate this? Because frankly, I think we have a president from Delaware, if I'm not mistaken. The president of the United States, I think he's from Delaware, right?
Yeah, he is.
Okay. His wife is also a community college teacher, from what I understand, I think.
Correct.
So I think they have a real strong interest in education. And maybe they've already heard of what you're doing, but if they haven't, I sure hope that the word can get out to them that they should spend some time or send their people up to see what you're doing so we can get this into more communities.
Well, I know if Art Taylor says it, then I think they're definitely listening. So hopefully.
So here's a question. So remember what was going on in Harlem, right? The Harlem Children's Zone was kind of a similar concept and wildly successful. Jeffrey Canada did some amazing things, you know, up there in Harlem. And it became sort of a model of sorts for others to look at and try to emulate. The reality was that while it was a great school, Jeffrey did an amazing job and the people there raising funds for that operation. Mm-hmm. And at one point I heard it was, you know, for that area, they were needing to bring in like $60 million a year or something like that, maybe more. Mm-hmm. And other people would say, well, we don't have that in our community. We don't have the ability to access that kind of money. So are you building something that is, I would say, inaccessible to many communities, or is this something that is within the budgets of different school districts around the country? I know that there are school districts that are under resourced. We know that. But let's assume that we have a school district that should be spending, I don't know, I'm throw out a number, $10,000 per child. Mm-hmm. Can we do it with that? Can we do it with what the average school district brings in per year? Can we do what you're talking about?
Yes, yes, yes. And I'll give you context. We get less money than district schools in the state. Charter schools in Delaware get less money than district schools. I get 20% less per child than any district student, 20 to 30%. So we fundraise on average about $300,000 a year. We're doing more than that right now because of higher need and because of some more things we're doing. But yes, the first question is, what are we trying to accomplish? And even before that, the mindset needs to be that we love our children and we're also taking ownership of the problem, because if we start pointing fingers, it's very easy. We can feel a lot better and adults feel better. and adults can argue about what's going to happen, but the children suffer. There's a proverb that says that when the elephants fight, only the grass suffers. Adults have been fighting for so long and hurting children as blades of grass and are inconsequential because that's not really our issue. It's because I care about ego and want to fight somebody else. So take ownership. That should be how you problem solve. We dealt with the flood and we asked our friends to help out. And we found that to be the case. We could do those things. We have taken transportation funding and focused on how to enlist parents in the bus driver shortage. And we did that with it's budget neutral for us. We did COVID testing in our community because we needed schools to open for our families to be safe and to be connected to schools and be engaged. And with, I think we are the first school in the entire nation that did COVID testing for every staff, every student in September of 2020 to make sure schools open 5 days a week. We did that without money because we looked at our partners and we started talking with our state agencies, our county agencies. Matt Meyer, our county exec, jumped on board phone calls with me, and I was yelling and screaming, we have to make sure that our children are getting the best education possible. Our community needs it. We have leaders that jumped on board and said, we agree, and they stepped forward. So we're not, the success we've had is not because we're investing tons of money. The success we've had is because we are owning the problem. The outcome of that is that people then start supporting what you're doing. Money follows vision. Vision never follows money.
Amen to that. So we're about toward the end of this, but I got two questions for you. The first one is, what do you say to someone else out there who is maybe heading in to be a principal of a tough situation? What do you say to that person that will inspire their leadership? That's one thing. And secondly, what do we do? How do we help you? How can the public help you in what you're doing? What can we do?
The second part, what you can do is you can always go to eastsidecharterschool.org and you can click on donate now. You can also engage with us and just see some of the projects taking place to see our impact on our community. I think you can check us out on Facebook and you can see just incredible updates and just sharing what's taking place. We also have something called an impact lecture where I know for your listeners, lots of impactful people out there. And we say, if you are making an impact, come talk to our children. So Art, we would definitely have you down for an impact lecture.
We love that.
And it's important for our children to see people that look like them and people that don't look like them to learn how they got there.
Yeah.
We had January 6th, we had the governor of Delaware give an impact lecture to our children, and we never knew that January 6th would be the day that an insurrection took place. Following that, we had our congresswoman come on, Lisa Blunt Rochester, and tell children this is what it was like inside and broke down to tears with them in Zoom. So we're asking people to come in and share that. The first question, what do I tell people? You got to examine if what you're doing is really about making an impact. Some people get into leadership because they want to make more money. If money is your desire, then go find a place that makes money outside of education. There's a lot more money outside of education than there is inside education. But if you are looking to make an actual impact and you want to leverage that impact and that's why you're doing it, then get in the field and do that. And go back to how we started this whole thing off, mentorship. You have to surround yourself with people that have been battle tested, that have wisdom, that will support you and can also give you correction. I have mentors that will call me up, can praise me and chastise me in the same breath because that's what I need. So being open to feedback matters a lot, and start building relationships with your families. If you are not invited to the barbecue, if you do not know the ins and outs of your families, then you shouldn't be in education because you're doing it for something other than actually impacting the lives and the souls of the people you're working with. So that's what I tell them. And I also tell them, get into a classroom first. It is better to be a teacher. Know the ins and outs of pedagogy and of the real life experiences of educators before you jump into a leadership seat. And listen to this podcast. That's what I would tell them now, too.
Well, the next thing is one day you're going to be Secretary of Education. And No, I'm writing that down right now, today in September 16th, when we're recording this, of 2021, I'm marking it down that Aaron Bass will be Secretary of Education. I'm calling it today. Well, Aaron, listen, thanks for being my guest on the Heart of Giving podcast. And I am so impressed with what you're doing. And I just hope that more educators learn about what you're doing so that we can replicate this success in places that sorely need it. And just thank you for being you and for taking such an interest and making education such a passion, because I can see how that makes a difference for the lives of these kids and their families.
I appreciate you, brother. Thank you for having me.
All right. You've been listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Aaron Bass, who is the CEO of the Eastside Charter School in Delaware. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen to other episodes by just going to any of the major podcast platforms. You can also follow us and subscribe on Patreon if you want to make a donation, patreon.com. And also make a comment on, especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love to get a favorable review on Apple Podcasts because that helps us to build audience. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.